Tequila in the Bluegrass from the Gecko Brothers in that set. Hopefully you dug it. Tune in next week, same time, same place, same channel, WHFR Dearborn for the Wrecking Hours. That's it for your friendly neighborhood beatnik. The Gothic Billy Man signing off.
This fall, Henry Ford Community College's Theater for Young Audiences is proud to present its production of Bridge to Terabithia, based on the novel by Katherine Patterson. Bridge to Terabithia is perfect for educational experience in the arts, providing a tale of friendship, imagination, and facing your fears. The production will be fully staged in the Adrey Auditorium here on the Dearborn campus, located at 5101 Evergreen Road. Student seating is just $3. Teachers and chaperones are free. Performances are Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 10 a.m. The show runs from November 12th through the 16th and returns November 26th through the 30th. For more information and to reserve seating, please call 313-845-9817.
My name is Ruth Rusi, and this is how I live United. I read to children as part of United Way's education program. It helps them create links between language and literacy and prepares them for a better academic future. I figure I have the time and they have the need. My name is Ruth Rusi. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford Community College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the Alternative Energy Program, please contact HFCC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
Hello, this is CD the DJ. Please join me every Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. as I bring you The World of Music, where we travel the world in search of your kind of music from all parts of the world, where we're making waves at WHFR. So come travel with me and enjoy the journey.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Reed McManus, senior editor at Sierra Magazine, about his new story on electric cars. We'll also talk with Courtney Height about the upcoming elections. Joining us now in our studio is Reed McManus. He's a senior editor at Sierra Magazine, and he recently did a piece about the new electric cars that are coming out, comparing a number of the electric vehicles that are on the market today. And we're here to talk about it with him. Welcome, Reed.
Hello, Orly. Good to be here.
So tell us about some of the different cars that you covered in this piece. I mean, what are the differences in price and in range? How did you come to tackle the subject, and what did you learn?
Well, we came to tackle the subject because the Sierra Club has a goal of helping the U.S. cut its oil use by 50% by the year 2030. Mm-hmm. And since 70% of oil is used for transportation, the best way to go at that is to cut its use in vehicles. What's interesting is that the fleet of electric and plug-in electric vehicles is hit critical mass. We were able to cover 9 vehicles in our article that just came out. And since then, there are at least 3 or 4 new ones available. I'm already hearing from people saying, hey, how come you didn't cover such and such? Well, we were covering the 9 vehicles that the EPA had already assessed, and the market just keeps growing.
And what's interesting about this, I think people used to think of electric cars as this very unusual thing. You know, it was not something that you would see. I'm starting to actually see some of these cars on the street.
There's critical mass. I mean, you're seeing lots of Chevy Volts. The Nissan Leaf is almost ubiquitous in a place like San Francisco. What I found amusing with my story is I first started out driving a Ford Focus EV, and it looks just like a Ford Focus. It doesn't look like an electric car, because we do think of electric cars as buggies. Mm-hmm. But these, what's interesting about electric cars and what was most surprising to me is you can approach them because you can approach them as a do-gooder, that I want to cut oil use, therefore I'm going to look at an electric car. But you can also approach an electric car because they're really fun to drive. And what's interesting about an electric motor is that all of the power that the motor has is available the instant you hit the accelerator. So driving my little compact Ford Focus electric felt to me like I was driving a big Mercedes or BMW, because you could just hit the gas and pass like a banshee on the freeway. Now, you're not supposed to say that as an environmentalist, but come on.
You know. Well, it makes it better if the cars are fun, right? I mean, that's one of the complaints that that people have had in the past about, I mean, look, I saw one blogger reviewing that new Prius, the smaller version of the Prius, and he said it wasn't fun to drive. Well, I think if we're getting cars that are saving you money by not having to go to the pump and they're fun to drive, then that's how we'll hit critical mass.
Now, most people, when they look for cars, aren't necessarily looking for a car that's fun to drive. Most people need a car that gets the kids to school, gets to the supermarket, et cetera. So there are different camps of people when they look at cars. People in the car journalism industry tend to put a lot of emphasis on what's fun to drive.
Well, they go into that field because that's what they want to do, right?
But I had a blast driving them. I drove the Ford Focus EV, I drove the Nissan Leaf EV, and I drove a Toyota plug-in Prius. And the difference between the all-electrics and the plug-ins are that the all-electrics, you're simply relying on an electric motor. They tend to have a range of up to about 80, 90 miles before you need to plug it in, but you have no option if you run out. Mm-hmm. A plug-in hybrid, on the other hand, will drive on battery alone for a set number of miles. For the Chevy Volt, it's 38. For the Toyota, it's 11 to 15. And then when the battery power is used up, a small gas engine kicks in various ways. For the Volt, the gas engine kicks in to generate the battery. For the Prius, it actually kicks in like a normal Prius and runs the car. The advantage of the plug-ins is that you'll never, ever, ever get stranded unless we run out of gas stations. On the other hand, they don't have as high miles per gallon equivalent as the all-electrics. Now, miles per gallon equivalent is a concoction that the EPA came up with to compare apples and oranges, to compare the energy use of a gasoline-powered car to the energy use of an electric car. And so they have this phrase called miles per gallon equivalent. And you can get as high as 118 miles per gallon equivalent with the Honda Fit EV. With the Chevy Volt, it's 98. With the Toyota Prius, it's 95. So you're really doing quite well with miles per gallon equivalent. Keep in mind that a standard, which is funny now that we call it, that we would call a standard Toyota Prius, the hybrid that we've seen on the road for a dozen years now, gets about 50 miles per gallon. Mm-hmm. So to get 100 miles per gallon equivalent is basically doubling the energy efficiency, and that's why they're so interesting.
So you mentioned the Honda Fit EV. Is that all-electric, no gasoline engine?
That's an all-electric. There, again, there are about six all-electrics. Actually, I think I just checked the EPA website, and there's now, I think, 10 all-electrics available, still three plug-in hybrids available.
How do these, and I know we're talking about a really wide range of different cars, but how are they on cost? I mean, I know some of them are obviously more expensive than a standard car, but then you're saving money on gas. So for which of these does it seem to even out or be, you know, somewhat affordable?
Cost in automobiles is always a tough situation, even with internal combustion cars. You can get a $16,000 car or a $36,000 car or a $46,000 car. So people look at various things, various factors when they decide how much money to spend. I'm not dodging the question, but it needed as a preface because most electric cars, the sticker price is somewhere, tends to be around in the high 30s, around 40. And for a compact car, you'd say, my God, that's a lot of money. However, almost all of them get a $7,500 federal tax credit, which brings the price for almost all of them to around $30,000, and right now the average cost of a car in the U.S. is nearly $31,000. So factor in the federal tax credit, and they're pretty cost competitive on purchase price. Now, operating the cars is another factor. The EPA looks at the annual cost of fuel for electric and plug-ins, and they average out about $500 or $600 a year in fuel costs, whereas an average midsize internal combustion engine you'd be spending $2,000, $2,200 a year on fuel. So right off the bat, you tend to be saving $1,100 to $1,500 per year in fuel costs. So when you figure out the payback, I think the one group that the New York Times used figured out that a Nissan Leaf all-electric would take 8.7 years to pay back compared to a compact Nissan Verso gas engine. But that's also not people don't buy cars simply on price. If mm-hmm. they want a car that operates on electricity alone and frees them from the oil system, there's a cost value in that. And that, frankly, was besides the fact of, that for me, realizing how fun these cars were to drive, what I found most amazing about driving these cars is it gives an individual a soul-lifting answer to the question, what are you going to do? I mean, for those of we've grown up with oil embargoes and smog and air pollution, and for those of us who haven't given up cars entirely, and God love the people who've given up cars entirely and gone to walking and public transit only, but for those of us who do feel we need a vehicle, it's always been sort of hand-wringing. What am I going to do? It's amazing when you're driving an electric car and you pass row after row of gas stations and you realize you're not at all connected to that infrastructure anymore. It really feels good. And that's worth something right there.
And how long does it take to charge some of these cars?
With the all-electrics, most people will opt to buy a 240-volt charger for their homes, and those cost around $2,000. That means that when you come home, you can plug in. It'll take 3 to 4 hours. You tend to plug in at night just the way you plug in your smartphone. There are now something like 11,000 public charging stations and more growing in the U.S. where you can go plug in, go to the movies, go shopping, come back, and your car is topped off. Mm-hmm. I had a funny experience where I was driving the Nissan Leaf in San Francisco, and I pulled into a San Francisco parking garage, and the city is offering free electric charging to get to give the market a boost. And I was jostling for position with a driver of a Chevy Volt for the last remaining charging station, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. There was a Tesla sitting there, another Nissan Leaf. The place was just full of electric cars. And it turned out that a block and a half away at Moscone Convention Center was a Apple software developers conference. And so these guys are early adopters. They had their electric cars. Mm-hmm. What was interesting was that I still had plenty of charge in my Nissan Leaf to get home. I was just topping off the way you might plug in your cell phone at work during the day, even though you could get home. And the point there is that most Americans drive no more than 40 miles a day. So even an electric car with a range of 85 miles before you have to plug in, for most Americans is absolutely fine. For people who have longer commutes, for people who take long driving trips where an electric car just wouldn't work and they might not have another car in their household, they would probably be swayed to look at a plug-in hybrid. But there are plenty of options out there.
And for people who don't buy that special $2,000 charger, can you just plug your electric car into the regular outlet in your garage?
You can plug it into a regular standard household outlet, but for an all-electric car, it may take 18 hours to charge. Mm-hmm. So you would quickly tire of that. Mm-hmm. You know, with the plug-in hybrids, like the Toyota and the Chevy Volt, you probably could get away with just using the household current because they are smaller batteries that have a smaller range. But I would imagine for an all-electric owner, they would opt for the 240-volt charger pretty quickly.
And how much does this cost on your electricity bill, just, you know, per charge on average?
It totally depends on your utility. Most figures I've seen are that it costs 2 to 3 mm-hmm. cents per mile to operate an electric car as opposed to upwards of 15 cents a mile for an internal combustion engine driven car. Really depends on your utility. Many utilities are giving special rates to electric car owners because they're using electricity in the middle of the night when there's no demand. A utility has plenty of electricity to hand out. They would like to sell that electricity rather than see you put gas in your tank. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on your own utility.
But I've heard it can be the equivalent of just like a few dollars to
fill pennies.
The tank.
It's pennies. Yeah. The Chevy Volt ads that are now running on TV are very cute because they have all these real Chevy Volt owners who are talking about how cheap it is and how infrequently they go to gas stations now, which is really, really true.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Reed McManus talking about a piece that he wrote in the new issue of Sierra Magazine. And to see the chart of all the different electric cars that are on the market and what they cost and what the range is, you can visit sierramagazine.com. The article's all up there, and you can check out some of these different cars like the Ford Focus, the Honda Fit EV, the Nissan Leaf, the Chevy Volt, the plug-in Prius, and high-end models like the Tesla. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Courtney Height from the Sierra Club's political program to talk with us about the elections. Welcome.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about these two ballot initiatives, one in Michigan and one in California, that the Sierra Club is really heavily involved in. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yes, definitely. So I'll start with California. We have two measures here, one that we are supporting and one that we are opposing. I'll start with Proposition 32, which is a is a very shady, deceptive proposal that basically is masquerading as a proposal to limit corporate spending in elections. However, it would effectively limit the rights of workers to have their voices heard through organized labor and actually engage in the political process. So it's a very interesting bill that would actually limit the voice of the people but increase the voice of corporate executives, law firms, venture capital investors, land developers. It could also have a negative impact on the Sierra Club as well and our ability to engage in political activity and actually defend clean air and clean water. So this is a very deceptive bill that we are heavily encouraging folks to vote no on. So that's the first one. And then I think the second one is one that we're actually very excited about, Proposition 39. And this bill would actually increase the opportunity for energy efficiency. So it would basically close corporate loopholes that currently exist and then generate billions of dollars in new funds for education and fund job-creating energy efficiency and clean energy projects at schools and other public buildings. And then this would in turn save money on heating and cooling bills for those public buildings for decades to come. So there's a lot of, a little bit of more investment at the front, but it saves money in the long term and keeps our air clean. So this is another one that we're heavily promoting and very excited about.
And then what about the big proposal in Michigan? We had someone on the show a while back to talk about that. I know it's a proposal to increase renewable energy in Michigan to 25% by 2025. How is that looking? Why is it important? Why is Michigan a place to watch in this area?
This is definitely very exciting as well. It's Proposition 3. And basically, this would guarantee that the state gets more of its electricity from clean energy sources. And it would also, at the same time, create 100,000 new Michigan jobs that can't be outsourced. They would be, homegrown in Michigan. And then this would also lead to an additional $10 billion in new investments in Michigan businesses. So it's a win all the way around, which is very exciting. And this is a huge priority for the Sierra Club. And we really are looking at this as being an opportunity to share, if we can pass this here, show that the people want this from the ground up, since we're hitting some major roadblocks with members of Congress and making some of this progress. What we're really trying to focus is that through people, we can actually make the difference on the ground and hopefully, take this to other states in the future.
And for our listeners who aren't in Michigan or California, because we have folks from all over the country who tune into the show, I thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about this effort that Sierra Club is getting involved in concerning getting money out of politics and strengthening our democracy. Particularly money from the fossil fuel industry out of politics. Can you tell me what we're seeing out there that's getting folks so fired up?
Yeah, I think over the last year and a half, we've seen more money being pumped into elections than ever before, with the onslaught of Citizens United. And it's all coming from a small cadre of really rich oil executives and Wall Street executives. And basically, they're buying off our elected officials. But what they've also realized is that to maintain that power and money, they have to stop the one thing that can stop them, which is votes and people that can make sure that the puppets that they place in elected office actually are listening to us. And so all of this money is now not only going into buy off elected officials, but the same people are actually funding efforts to take away voting rights and deliberately suppressing the rights of many Americans, millions of Americans, to vote. In 2011 alone, more than 180 bills were introduced in 41 different states that would increase barriers to voting and actually getting to the ballot. And so this is something that, from the Sierra Club's angle, if we're decreasing the amount of people that can participate in our democracy, that hurts all of us. So this is something that's definitely, we're starting to kind of connect the dots and realizing it's the same fight that we're all fighting.
What is the Sierra Club doing to make a difference in particular? I mean, who are we working with?
Yeah, so it's actually very exciting. We've partnered with the NAACP and the Communication Workers of America and Greenpeace. And what we're looking to do is just kind of take, our collective power. We have a lot of people and we have a lot of, networks across the country. And we're starting to work together and realize we will be much stronger if we work collectively to actually, address these issues. And so we're in the process of building a broad-based coalition, bringing together folks that have been working on, fighting money in politics for decades, kind of in the good government community, and also bringing together folks from the voting rights community who have been, you know, defending our democracy for years as well, and then also bringing in some non-traditional players like ourselves, you know, like the Sierra Club and organizations like the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, NARAL, and other, you know, women's organizations to collectively work on this. And then some individual things that we're doing is really focusing on educating our members and our, you know, our vast network of kind of connecting the dots of you know, the attacks on voting rights hurt us just as much as all this money being pumped in. So we're actually activating our network of lawyers that we have across the country to help with election protection activities from now until the election. We're also in the process of setting up state coalitions, you know, working with our existing chapters and really trying to network and work more collaboratively with NAACP, communication workers, and some other labor unions as well, at the state level, to kind of do some proactive work around, you know, passing some state legislation and other options. So we're just getting embarking on this, but we're at the process of, you know, broadening out the coalition at this point and identifying, you know, where we should focus in the next year and for years to come as well.
Anything else about the elections that you want to add?
No, I mean, I think, you know, this election is, again, we're seeing more money than we've ever seen before, but I think, you know, the one thing that Sierra Club has that we continue to be our strength is that we have, you know, 1.5 million people. We have people all over the country, and that's still the one thing that can push back on the money and you know, face-to-face educating each other about why this election is important. So I just hope folks get out and vote.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Courtney Hite from the Sierra Club's political program. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
Today we're going to talk about some tips to avoid toxic mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that and how it affects people.
Yeah, 70% of the mercury that we're exposed to comes from human activities. And most of that comes initially from burning coal. So what happens is the coal-fired power plants in our country pump tens of tons of mercury into the atmosphere every year. It ends up settling into our oceans and lakes and waterways and gets absorbed into the flesh of fish, which we then eat, which then causes problems in our bodies. And a lot of seafood is safe to eat. There's actually a really good chart in Sierra Magazine. If you go to sierramagazine.com and look for it, it should be there. But the general rule of thumb is you want to eat smaller fish that are lower on the food chain rather than big fish that are higher on the food chain. So if you're really looking to avoid mercury, you'll want to avoid tuna, especially Chilean sea bass, swordfish. A lot of those are endangered species anyways, so you don't want to eat them regardless. But if you have to eat fish and you want to avoid mercury, then flounder's a good option, catfish, anchovies, any of the smaller fish that, you know, that diagram of the fish eating the fish eating the fish. You want to be eating the smaller fish. It's on that chart and not the big one.
And what is the some of the what are the problems with mercury?
Yeah, so it kind of depends who you are. So they're all fairly similar, but they're especially bad for women and babies, especially women of childbearing age. And the EPA has estimated that as many as 1 in 12 American women of childbearing age have enough mercury in their body to put a baby at risk. And what that means is that babies or fetuses in utero can have birth defects from being too exposed to this toxic heavy metal. And that includes neurological and developmental disorders, learning disabilities, delayed onset of normal things like walking and talking, cerebral palsy. Kids born with it in their system also have trouble with coordination and concentration, language, memory, and this stuff doesn't go away. They continue to have these same deficits many years later.
So it's a problem for adults too, right?
It is, yeah. And there have been some high-profile cases of this in pop culture and in celebrities, but what happens if you start to experience symptoms of lack of balance and coordination, trouble concentrating, you losing your motor skills a little bit, tremors, muscle weakness, memory problems, slurred speech. I'm starting to sound like one of those drug commercials, but like all those things are possible symptoms of mercury poisoning. And if you're eating a lot of fish, and especially if you're eating a lot of the larger fishes, then you might want to start you might want to go to the doctor and get it checked out, get tested for mercury, and maybe just start cutting out those fish.
Now, the good news, as I understand it, is that as soon as you change up your diet, cut out the kinds of fish that are high in mercury, you do start to see immediate changes returning to a normal mercury-free state.
That's right. This is a rare medical disorder that you can quickly turn around just by your lifestyle change, but just by simply your diet. And it's a clear-cut case when, you know, mercury that starts out in coal plants stops being in your body, then you start feeling fine again. It really is easily reversible.
Now, again, there is still plenty of seafood that's safe to eat, especially those smaller fish. But I think the bigger thing is if we can just eliminate the mercury that comes from these coal-burning power plants, then all of the fish would theoretically become safe to eat,
exactly.
Right?
That's the main point, is that if we stop having all of these toxic coal plants, then we won't have mercury poisoning and many other health problems in our system. And it's billions of dollars a year that we're losing, not only in healthcare costs, but in lost productivity. For mercury poisoning alone, they estimate the cost at being $1.3 billion each year for the American economy just because of mercury poisoning. So that, you know, couple that with asthma and all the other problems that burning coal presents in our society, and it becomes a clear-cut case to get rid of that and move to cleaner energy.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine. And for those of you who would like to find out more, you can go to sierraclub.org/mercury. I believe there you'll be able to find a list of the fish that are safe to eat, and also download our iPhone and Android app that can tell you all about safe sushi, finding out which types of sushi are high or low in mercury.
Thanks, Orly.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Please join us for a WHFR benefit featuring live blues music on Saturday, November 17th.
Take a ride now, baby. Come and ride with me.
With solo artist Leonardo.
The woman I love, I took her for my best friend. That joker got lucky. Look back again.
Machine Gun Kelly and her band, The Thugs. And the Chris Canis Band.
Come and ride with me. Take a ride.
Only a $5 donation at the door for this fantastic show. 21 and over, please. Great blues music on Saturday, November 17th at the New Place Lounge in Dearborn. Don't miss it.
Oh, yeah. Come on now.
Packers.
Vikings.
Red State.
Blue State.
We come from different places.
Uptown.
Downtown.
We come to different conclusions.
Half empty.
Half full.
But no matter how different we are, we're all connected, and we can all make a difference. That's why United Way brings people, expertise, and resources together to improve the education, income, and health of our communities. The building blocks for a better life. When we live united, our efforts, magnified by others, add up to real change. Children succeed in school, families gain financial stability, the health of our neighbors improves, and suddenly, so do our communities. But real change won't happen without you.
Live united.
So let's look beyond our differences.
Live united.
One by one, let's make a difference. Let's reach out a hand to one and influence the condition of all.
Live united.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Sign up today at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
WebAdvisor, a program allowing students and staff access to college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, you are able to register for classes, view grades, track financial aid, print class schedules, and much more. Log into WebAdvisor by going to my.hfcc.edu/webadvisor or from the homepage, hfcc.edu.
Do you like gospel music? Gospel jazz, gospel hip-hop, urban contemporary, as well as traditional gospel music? If so, tune in every Sunday afternoon from 3 to 5 p.m. when I, Andy Parks, your host, will have nothing but the very best in gospel music on Strictly Gospel, right here on the station that's making waves, WHFR.FM.
In the 17th century, a woman named Giuliana Toffana had a very successful perfume business. For over 50 years, she ran it. It sort of ended abruptly when she was executed for murdering 600 men. You see, it wasn't a very good perfume. In fact, it was completely odorless and tasteless and colorless. But as a poison, it was the best money could buy. So women flocked to her in order to murder their husbands. It turns out that poisoners were a valued and feared group because poisoning a human being is a quite difficult thing. The reason is we have sort of a built-in poison detector. You can see this as early as even in newborn infants. If you are willing to do this, you can take a couple of drops of a bitter substance or a sour substance, and you'll see that face, the tongue stick out, the wrinkled nose, as if they're trying to get rid of what's in their mouth. This reaction expands into adulthood and becomes sort of a full-blown disgust response, no longer just about whether or not we're about to be poisoned, but whenever there's a threat of physical contamination from some source. But the face remains strikingly similar. It has expanded more, though, than just keeping us away from physical contaminants. And there's a growing body of evidence to suggest that, in fact, this emotion of disgust now influences our moral beliefs and even our deeply held political intuitions. Why this might be the case, we can understand this process by understanding a little bit about emotions in general. So the basic human emotions, those kinds of emotions that we share with all other human beings, exist because they motivate us to do good things and they keep us away from doing bad things. So by and large, they are good for our survival. Take the emotion of fear, for instance. It keeps us away from doing things that are really, really risky. This photo taken just before his death is actually one reason this photo is interesting is because most people would not do this, and if they did, they would not live to tell it, because fear would have kicked in a long time ago to a natural predator. Just like fear offers this protective benefit, disgust seems to do the same thing, except for what disgust does is keeps us away from not things that might eat us or heights, but rather things that might poison us or give us disease and make us sick. So one of the features of disgust that makes it such an interesting emotion is that it's very, very easy to elicit. In fact, more so than probably any of the other basic emotions. And so I'm going to show you that with a couple of images, I could probably make you feel disgust. So turn away. I'll tell you when you can turn back. I mean, you see it every day, right? I mean, come on. Okay, turn back. So if you didn't look. Those probably made a lot of you in the audience feel very, very disgusted. But if you didn't look, and I can tell you about some of the other things that have been shown sort of across the world to make people disgusted, things like feces, urine, blood, rotten flesh. These are the sorts of things that it makes sense for us to stay away from because they might actually contaminate us. In fact, just having a diseased appearance or odd sexual acts, these things are also things that give us a lot of disgust. Darwin was probably one of the first scientists to systematically investigate the human emotions, and he pointed to the universal nature and the strength of the disgust response. This is an anecdote from his travels in South America. In Tierra del Fuego, a native touched with his finger some cold preserved meat while I was eating and plainly showed disgust at its softness, while I felt utter disgust at my food being touched by a naked savage, though his hands did not appear dirty. He later wrote, it's okay, some of my best friends are naked savages. Well, it turns out it's not only old-timey British scientists who are this squeamish. I recently got a chance to talk to Richard Dawkins for a documentary, and I was able to discuss him a bunch of times. Here's my favorite.
We've evolved around courtship and sex, are attached to deep-rooted emotions and reactions that are hard to jettison overnight.
So my favorite part of this clip is that Professor Dawkins actually gagged. He jumps back and he gags, and we had to do it three times, and all three times he gagged. And he was really gagged. I thought he might throw up on me, actually. One of the features, though, of disgust is not just its universality and its strength, but the way that it works through association. So when one disgusting thing touches a clean thing, that clean thing becomes disgusting, not the other way around. This makes it very useful as a strategy if you want to convince somebody that an object or an individual or an entire social group is disgusting and should be avoided. The philosopher Martha Nussbaum points this out in this quote, "Thus throughout history, certain disgust properties, sliminess, bad smell, stickiness, decay, foulness, have repeatedly and monotonously been associated with Jews, women, homosexuals, untouchables, lower class people. All of those are imagined as tainted by the dirt of the body." Let me give you just some examples of how, some powerful examples of how this has been used historically. This comes from a Nazi children's book published in 1938. Just look at these guys, the louse-infested beards, the filthy protruding ears, those stained fatty clothes. Jews often have an unpleasant Swedish odor. If you have a good nose, you can smell the Jews. A more modern example comes from people who try to convince us that homosexuality is immoral. This is from an anti-gay website, where they said gays are worthy of death for their vile sex practices. They're like dogs eating their own vomit and sows wallowing in their own feces. These are disgust properties that are trying to be directly linked to the social group that you should not like. When we were first investigating the role of disgust in moral judgment, one of the things we became interested in was whether or not these sorts of appeals are more likely to work in individuals who are more easily disgusted. So while disgust, along with the other basic emotions, are universal phenomena, it just really is true that some people are easier to disgust than others. You could probably see it in the audience members when I showed you those disgusting images. The way that we measured this was by a scale that was constructed by some other psychologists that simply asked people across a wide variety of situations how likely they are to feel disgust. So here are a couple of examples. Even if I were hungry, I would not drink a bowl of my favorite soup if it had been stirred by a used but thoroughly washed fly swatter. Do you agree or disagree? While you're walking through a tunnel under a railroad track, you smell urine. Would you be very disgusted? Not at all disgusted. If you ask enough of these, you can get a general overall score of disgust sensitivity. It turns out that this score is actually meaningful. When you bring people into the laboratory and you ask them if they're willing to engage in safe but disgusting behaviors like eating chocolate that's been baked to look like dog poop, or in this case, eating some mealworms that are perfectly healthy but pretty gross, your score on that scale actually predicts whether or not you'll be willing to engage in those behaviors. The first time that we set out to collect data on this and associate it with political or moral beliefs, we found a general pattern. This is with the psychologists Yoel Inbar and Paul Bloom, that in fact, across three studies, we kept finding that people who reported that they were easily disgusted also reported that they were more politically conservative. Another way to say this, though, is that people who are very liberal are very hard to disgust. In a more recent follow-up study, we were able to look at a much greater sample, much larger sample. In this case, this is nearly 30,000 U.S. respondents, and we find the same pattern. As you can see, people who are on the very conservative side of answering the political orientation scale are also much more likely to report that they're easily disgusted. This data set also allowed us to statistically control for a number of things that we knew were both related to political orientation and to discuss sensitivity. So we were able to control for gender, age, income, education, even basic personality variables, and the result stays the same. When we actually looked at not just self-reported political orientation, but voting behavior, we were able to look geographically across the nation. What we found was that in regions in which people reported high levels of disgust sensitivity, McCain got more votes. So it not only predicted self-reported political orientation, but actual voting behavior. And also we were able, with this sample, to look across the world, 121 different countries. We asked the same questions. And as you can see, this is 121 countries collapsed into 10 different geographical regions. No matter where you look, what this is plotting is the size of the relationship between disgust sensitivity and political orientation. And no matter where we looked, we saw a very similar effect. Other labs have actually looked at this as well, using different measures of disgust sensitivity. So rather than asking people how easily disgusted they are, they hook people up to physiological measures, in this case, skin conductance. And what they've demonstrated is that people who report being more politically conservative are also more physiologically aroused when you show them disgusting images, like the ones that I showed you. Interestingly, what they also showed, and a finding that we kept getting in our previous studies as well, was that one of the strongest influences here is that individuals who are very disgust sensitive not only are more likely to report being politically conservative, but they're also very much more opposed to gay marriage and homosexuality and pretty much a lot of the socio-moral issues in the sexual domain. So physiological arousal predicted, in this study, attitudes toward gay marriage. But even with all these data linking disgust sensitivity and political orientation, one of the questions that remains is, what is the causal link here? Is it the case that disgust really is shaping political and moral beliefs? We have to resort to experimental methods to answer this. And so what we can do is actually bring people into the lab and disgust them and compare them to a control group that hasn't been disgusted. It turns out that over the past 5 years, a number of researchers have done this, and by and large, the results have all been the same, that when people are feeling disgust, their attitudes shift toward the right end of the political spectrum, toward more moral conservatism as well. So this is whether you use a foul odor, a bad taste, from film clips, from post-hypnotic suggestions of disgust, images like the ones I've shown you, even just reminding people that disease is prevalent and they should be wary of it and wash up, right, to keep clean. These all have similar effects on judgment. Let me just give you an example from a recent study that we conducted. We asked participants to just simply give us their opinion of a variety of social groups. And we either made the room smell gross or not. When the room smelled gross, what we saw was that individuals actually reported more negative attitudes toward gay men. Disgust didn't influence attitudes toward all the other social groups that we asked, including African Americans, the elderly. It really came down to the attitudes that they had toward gay men. In another set of studies, we actually simply reminded people, this was at a time when the swine flu was going around, we reminded people that in order to prevent the spread of the flu, that they ought to wash their hands. For some participants, we actually had them take questionnaires next to a sign that reminded them to wash their hands. And what we found was that just taking a questionnaire next to this hand sanitizing reminder made individuals report being more politically conservative. And when we asked them a variety of questions about the rightness or wrongness of certain acts, what we also found was that simply being reminded that they ought to wash their hand made them more morally conservative. In particular, when we asked them questions about sort of taboo but fairly harmless sexual practices, just being reminded that they ought to wash their hand made them think that they were more morally wrong. Let me give you an example of what I mean by harmless but taboo sexual practice. We gave them scenarios. One of them said a man is house-sitting for his grandmother. When his grandmother's away, he has sex with his girlfriend on his grandma's bed. In another one, we said a woman enjoys masturbating with her favorite teddy bear cuddled next to her. People find these to be more morally abhorrent if they've been reminded to wash their hands. Okay. The fact that emotions influence our judgment should come as no surprise. I mean, that's part of how emotions work. They not only motivate you to behave in certain ways, but they change the way you think. In the case of disgust, what is a little bit more surprising is the scope of this influence. It makes perfect sense, and it's a very good emotion for us to have, that disgust would make me change the way that I perceive the physical world whenever contamination is possible. It makes less sense that an emotion that was built to prevent me from ingesting poison should predict who I'm going to vote for in the upcoming presidential election. The question of whether disgust ought to influence our moral and political judgments certainly has to be complex and might depend on exactly what judgments we're talking about. And as a scientist, we have to conclude sometimes that the scientific method is just ill-equipped to answer these sorts of questions. But one thing that I am fairly certain about is, at the very least, what we can do with this research is point to what questions we ought to ask in the first place. Thank you.
So little Billy goes to school and he sits down and the teacher says, "What does your father do?" And little Billy says, "My father plays the piano in an opium den." So the teacher rings up the parents and says, "Very shocking story from little Billy today. Just heard that he claimed that you play the piano in an opium den." And the father says, "I'm very sorry. Yes, it's true. I lied. But how can I tell an 8-year-old boy that his father is a politician?" Now, as a politician myself, standing in front of you, or indeed meeting any stranger anywhere in the world, when I eventually reveal the nature of my profession, they look at me as though I'm somewhere between a snake, a monkey, and an iguana. And through all of this, I feel strongly that something is going wrong. 400 years of maturing democracy, colleagues in Parliament who seem to me as individuals reasonably impressive, an increasingly educated, energetic, informed population, and yet a deep, deep sense of disappointment. My colleagues in Parliament include, in my new intake, family doctors, business people, professors, distinguished economists, historians, writers, army officers ranging from colonels down to regimental sergeant majors. All of them, however, including myself, as we walk underneath those strange stone gargoyles just down the road, feel that we become less than the sum of our parts, feel as though we have become profoundly diminished. And this isn't just a problem in Britain. It's a problem across the developing world, and in middle-income countries too. In Jamaica, for example, Look at Jamaican members of parliament, you meet them, and they're often people who are Rhodes Scholars, who've studied at Harvard or at Princeton, and yet you go down to downtown Kingston and you are looking at one of the most depressing sights that you can see in any middle-income country in the world. A dismal, depressing landscape of burnt and half-abandoned buildings. And this has been true for 30 years. And the handover in 1979, 1980, between one Jamaican leader who was the son of a Rhodes Scholar and a QC to another who'd done an economics doctorate at Harvard, over 800 people were killed in the streets in drug-related violence. 10 years ago, however, the promise of democracy seemed to be extraordinary. George W. Bush stood up in his State of the Union address in 2003 and said that democracy was the force that would beat most of the ills of the world. He said, because democratic governments respect their own people and respect their neighbors, freedom will bring peace. Distinguished academics at the same time argued that democracies had these incredible range of side benefits. They would bring prosperity, security, overcome sectarian violence, ensure that states would never again harbor terrorists. Since then, what's happened? Well, what we've seen is the creation in places like Iraq and Afghanistan of democratic systems of government which haven't had any of those side benefits. In Afghanistan, for example, we haven't just had one election or two elections, we've gone through three elections, presidential and parliamentary. And what do we find? Do we find a flourishing civil society, a vigorous rule of law and good security? No. What we find in Afghanistan is a judiciary that is weak and corrupt, a very limited civil society, which is largely ineffective, a media which is beginning to get onto its feet, but a government that's deeply unpopular, perceived as being deeply corrupt, and security that is shocking, security that's terrible. In Pakistan, in lots of sub-Saharan Africa, again, you can see democracy and elections are compatible with corrupt governments, with states that are unstable and dangerous. And when I have conversations with people, I remember having a conversation, for example, in Iraq with a community that asked me whether the riot we were seeing in front of us, this was a huge mob ransacking a provincial council building, was a sign of the new democracy. The same, I felt, was true in almost every single one of the middle and developing countries that I went to, and to some extent, the same is true of us. Well, what is the answer to this? Is the answer to just give up on the idea of democracy? Well, obviously not. It would be absurd if we were to engage again in the kind of operations we were engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, if we would suddenly find ourselves in a situation in which we were imposing anything other than a democratic system. Anything else would run contrary to our values, it would run contrary to the wishes of the people on the ground, it would run contrary to our interests. I remember in Iraq, for example, that we went through a period of feeling that we should delay democracy. We went through a period of feeling that the lesson learned from Bosnia was that elections held too early enshrined sectarian violence, enshrined extremist parties. So in Iraq in 2003, a decision was made, let's not have elections for 2 years. Let's invest in voter education. Let's invest in democratization. The result was that I found, stuck outside my office, a huge crowd of people. This is actually a photograph taken in Libya, but I saw the same scene in Iraq of people standing outside screaming for the elections. And when I went out and said, what is wrong with the interim provincial council? What is wrong with the people that we have chosen? There is a Sunni sheikh, there's a Shia sheikh, there's the seven leaders of the seven major tribes, there's a Christian, there's a Sabian, there are female representatives, there's every political party in this council. What's wrong with the people that we chose? The answer came, the problem isn't the people that you chose, the problem is that you chose them. I have not met in Afghanistan, in even the most remote community, anybody who does not want a say in who governs them. Most remote community, I've never met a villager who does not want a vote. So, we need to acknowledge that despite the dubious statistics, despite the fact that 84% of people in Britain feel politics is broken, despite the fact that when I was in Iraq, we did an opinion poll in 2003 and asked people what political systems they preferred, and the answer came back that 7% wanted the United States, 5% wanted France, 3% wanted Britain, and nearly 40% on which we stand, banqueting halls with extraordinary images on the ceiling of kings enthroned. The entire drama played out here on this space where the King of England had his head lopped off. Why we've moved from spaces like this, thrones like that, towards the town hall is we're moving more and more towards the energies of our people, and we need to tap that. That can mean different things in different countries. In Britain, it could mean looking to the French, learning from the French, getting directly elected mayors in place in a French commune system. In Afghanistan, it could have mean, instead of concentrating on the big presidential and parliamentary elections, we should have done what was in the Afghan constitution from the very beginning, which is to get direct local elections going at a district level and elect people's provincial governors. But for any of these things to work, the honesty in language, the local democracy, it's not just a question of what politicians do, it's a question of what the citizens do. For politicians to be honest, the public needs to allow them to be honest. And the media, which mediates between the politicians and the public, needs to allow those politicians to be honest. If local democracy is to flourish, it is about the active and informed engagement of every citizen. In other words, if democracy is to be rebuilt, is to become again vigorous and vibrant, it is necessary not just for the public to learn to trust their politicians, but for the politicians to learn to trust the public. Thank you very much indeed.
Probably not the best candidate, mostly because he's a fictional character. But if you're a registered voter, make sure you get out there and vote in this November's elections. Just a friendly reminder from us here at WHFR.
My sport is football, but my passion is education. My name is Nnamdi Asamoah, and this is how I live United. I see too many kids miss out on moving up, kids who could go on to college but just need that extra little push. So every year, I take promising high school students on a college tour. We check out the dorms, the library, meet some professors, find out where the best late-night grub stops are. It shows them that there's a whole world beyond their own. But what's even better is that most of these kids decide college is for them. I'm Nnamdi Asamoah. I show kids that a higher education means a brighter future. So when it comes to living United, I don't just wear the shirt, I live it. Join me.
You can be a reader, tutor, or mentor too. Take the pledge at liveunited.org/volunteer. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
WHFR.